All right, this is our last class for this quarter, and those of you who are not coming back next time, we'll miss you. I assume you'll be teaching somewhere or a different class or whatever, but hope you've gotten a little bit out of the class this quarter. So we'll run through the review right quick and then move into some new stuff and finish up the period of retirements. When we finish tonight, we'll be down, and it's a slide later on that says this, we'll be down to 6 months before Jesus is on the cross. 6 months before his death. So next quarter, we'll cover that 6 months, and then the last week will be the emphasis of the next quarter. So looking at the fourth retirement, there are four of them. If we get time, I have a summary to end. We'll hit on all four of them and kind of review them right quick, but we'll get that far. But Jesus and his disciples are crossing the Sea of Galilee. They're actually going toward Bethsaida, and they realize they didn't take enough bread, enough food to eat. And Jesus picks up on this and talks to them about the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians. And disciples get confused. They think he's talking about food to eat, and he's really trying to get to them about the doctrine of the Pharisees. And Sadducees, he says, because there's no problem. As far as physical food, you saw me feed the 5,000, you saw me feed the 4,000. You know, that's not it. It's the spiritual food that I want you to put an emphasis on. And we talked about how does that apply to us. And then be aware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And again, what doctrine are we hearing that we need to be aware of and pay attention to and not heed and things like this. And they search the scriptures. Acts 17 to make sure what was taught was true. So they go over to Bethsaida, actually going up to Caesarea Philippi. Again, he's getting away from the crowds with his disciples. And they get up to near Mount Hermon. This is Mount Hermon up here. Caesarea Philippi is right at the base of it. This is Dan. Remember the expression, Dan to Beersheba, the north part of the south part of the land. It's Mount Hermon up here. And this is Caesarea Philippi, just right below. Here's Mount Hermon, Caesarea Philippi there. So Jesus asked his apostles there, who do men say that I am? And it's just a way to learn, to see what they know, what they're learning, what's going on around them. So they come back with several names, like John the Baptist who's risen from the dead, or Elijah, or Jeremiah, or one of the great prophets. So then he turns around and asks him a question. This is Caesarea Philippi. This will be part of the headwaters of the Jordan River. We'll finish that the other night. He asked him, said, who do you say I am? This is what the people say. Who do you say? And Peter speaks up and says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And makes that confession. And so Jesus comes back and said, blessed are you, and upon this rock I'll build my church. And we talked about the rock and how the denominations, particularly Catholics, will make the rock Peter and give him preeminence. So we'll talk about that in tonight's lesson a little bit. But really it's the confession Peter made that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the living God. And that's the confession, that's the rock, that's the foundation that Jesus is going to build the church on. We talked about the word church meaning an assembly, a called out special group, and various passages here that refer to it being a called out group, called out of darkness and there's marvelous light, and etc. So we went through that. And then verse 19 talks about give you the keys to the kingdom. Again, verse causes trouble for some people. Say they're going to unlock the kingdom with their sermons they're going to preach. And what you bound on earth will be bound in heaven. And New American Standard gives a better translation of that. What you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven. You're not going to make any laws on earth in dictating what the doctrine of Christ will be. Christ is the King. He makes the laws and that. But then Jesus tells them the first of 22 times in this lesson that he's going to be killed. He's going to go to Jerusalem, suffer many things, be killed, will third day be raised. And Peter talks about it. Not so, Lord, not so. And Jesus tells him it's got to be. It's got to be that way. That's basically what he comes out with. So they'll understand this, and we'll get it again in a minute at the end of the lesson. So he said, anyone who wants to follow after me has to deny himself. And we talked a little bit about what does it mean to deny self, to take all of my personal interests out. Anything that I want, my desires are put aside because of Christ. And he says, take up your cross daily and follow me. And the vision we don't see that they would have seen would be of a criminal carrying his cross, bearing his cross, physically bearing his cross. You think about Jesus after he'd been beaten nearly to death, bearing his cross and having to have Simon help with it. So when he says, take up your cross and follow me, it had a more special meaning to them than it would to us. And then he says, follow me. Then he says, whoever desires to save his life will lose it. Who wants to lose his life will save it, which is kind of a backward sounding type thing there. But really, one guy talks about this to me, the philosophy of dying in order to live. So we die to ourselves, put ourselves out, so we may live for Christ. Verse 26, what did it profit a man if he gains the whole world, loses his own soul? In other words, what are you going to give in exchange for your soul? What do we have? What do we want? What will we get? What could we get that's worth paying the debt for our sins? And that, of course, is nothing but the blood of Christ. We'll add to that, pay that debt. So then move into the transfiguration then. Jesus takes Peter, James, and John, goes up to a high mountain. It doesn't say which mountain. It says a high mountain. So we talked about it being possibly Mount Hermon, which is up here in the very top, 9,000 plus feet above sea level. Now, of course, keep in mind, they've been at Caesarea Philippi right before this, so it's kind of logical that it might be Mount Hermon. There's a picture of Mount Hermon range here, all the snow cap. And then some think it might be Mount Tabor. There's actually, Steve said he had a dozen pictures of Mount Tabor, and there's actually a shrine or a memorial or a building or something there on Mount Tabor that's supposed to be the typical of the, what's the right word I'm looking for, the historical place of the Transfiguration, I guess, the traditional place is what I'm looking for, the traditional place of the Transfiguration on Mount Tabor, which is looks like this. It's down in Galilee. So did they come back from up north and then back into Galilee before the Transfiguration? I tend to think it's Mount Hermon, but I couldn't prove it either way. So when he was there on the mountain, he was changed. His appearance was changed, transformed, just as we're transformed when we become Christians, not being conformed to this world, but being transformed, changed. And of course, Peter makes a suggestion to build three tabernacles, and Moses and Elijah appear, again signifying the law and the prophets. And of course, the voice speaks then and says, this is my beloved son, hear him. Hear him. And of course, look at Hebrews chapter 1. Times past spoken to us by the prophets, speak to us now by his son. And then that brings up the question about, do we hear just Jesus and what he says, the quote, quote, red letter type theory there. But there's plenty of passages to talk about. When you hear the people who are representing me, you hear the apostles, you hear the ones I send out, that you're actually hearing me. Okay. All scriptures give them best revelation. So then again, he tells about his death. Chapter 17, verse 22. Son of man is going to be betrayed to the hands of men. They'll kill him. The third day he'll be raised. And they were exceedingly sorrowful, Matthew says. But Mark adds that they didn't understand what he's talking about, for sure. They won't comprehend it yet. So that brings us down to Matthew 17, verse 20 through verse 23. We pick up there tonight, then if we move into tonight's lesson. Okay. They come back down, and they're in Capernaum. We start tonight. So we've been there multiple times before, northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. So Capernaum, where they start off. And Peter was asked, if your master, if Jesus, pays the temple tax. And the temple tax is something, go back, reference Exodus chapter 30. It's a tax that men 20 years and older paid, and it was a equal amount tax. Whether you were poor or whether you were rich, you paid the same amount in the temple tax. It was not a kind of probated type thing. Same amount for everybody. And Peter just replied that yes, he does. And Jesus then, when he came to the house, knew what had happened, and he anticipated what the conversation was going to be. So he asked Peter a question. From whom do the kings collect taxes? From strangers or from their own people? So they just a little back and forth about this a little bit. And so then Jesus tells Peter to go down and cast a hook into the sea. And when you bring up a fish, open the mouth, there'll be a coin in there. Take that coin and pay the temple tax for you and for me. And so he did this and paid that. Now we know that Matthew is the only one who records this. That's a little understandable, I guess, since Matthew was a tax collector. He might be the one that would insert this in. Of course, guided by the Spirit, I understand that. But it fits more into Matthew's realm type thing there. So then Jesus asked them, what were you discussing? What were you talking about? Disputing about, I think the word is used, as we came down the road. Now, some of the commentators think this is when they were actually traveling back from up Caesarea Philippi area back down toward Capernaum. But whatever. They were discussing, they were disputing about something. And Jesus knew that. So he asked them, what were you talking about? Well, they didn't want to tell him because it's a little embarrassing to them. They were talking about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. Now, stop and stick a note in here. Matthew chapter 16, we talked about a few minutes ago, several different verses that are taken, that's applied, and Peter is given the Pope to be type thing, if you will, by the Roman Catholics. But Peter's given us a place of prominence based on Matthew 16, verses 18, 19, 20, that area there. And then also, of course, on the Mount of Transfiguration, he's the one that spoke up there, so let's build the booths and with Elijah and Moses there. Think about it. If Peter had just been given some prominent position, I give you the keys to the kingdom, and you, Peter, will be the one that has these keys, etc. Why discuss who's going to be the greatest? It seems like that's already settled. If Peter's got this special prominent role up here, just a little sideline thought. So Jesus, in answering them or talking to them about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom, takes a little child and sets in their midst. He's going to use this child and characteristics of this child to talk to him about greatness. That's where we are now. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell of this event. So pick out whichever one you prefer to look at. Again, the kingdom's not established because we think if it were established, they would already be in the kingdom, but that's not the way it reads here. So, the question I have then, Jesus said, you must become as a little child if you want to enter the kingdom. How do you become as a little child? How did they become as a little child? How do we become as a little child? What does it mean, you must become as a little child? Yeah, we're going to get to that point in a minute. It's humility. It's the humility of a child. And we'll talk about that just in a minute there. That's what he's getting to. You must become as a little child. This child is sitting there. It's an object lesson, if you will, sitting there in the midst of them. Here it is. Whoever humbles himself as this little child, the child sitting here, is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. We'll come back and talk about at the end a minute, this humbling himself. We'll talk about that a minute there. But that's the lesson that Jesus gives them. Whoever humbles himself as this little child will be the greatest. First he says you have to be like a little child to enter the kingdom. And then he says whoever humbles himself as a little child will be greatest in the kingdom. So two different things the child is used for here. A couple of comments about this I read. He will be the greatest who has the least idea he is great. That's why one commentator said this. He will be the greatest who has the least idea that he is great. Another man said, unless they accepted the status of a, quote, nobody, they couldn't even enter the kingdom, much less be great in it. That kind of goes back, in my mind, to denying oneself, where you become, as it were, a, as he put it here, quote, a nobody. I take myself out. I deny myself. I may be in the kingdom. But Jesus says in the midst of all of this, he wants to be first, but has to be a servant to all. Now, just mentioned a few minutes ago about where Jesus is going to be 6 months from now. Think about that time for a minute, and that time he had him in the upper room now, just before his death. What did he do then to show them this servant attitude? Got Bible knowledge. He washed their feet. Yeah, thank you. He washed their feet. Jesus the Master washed the apostles' feet. Service. He wants to be first. He's going to be a servant to all. He tells them. And he's going to show them that more down the road. He says, receive a little child in my name and you receive me. And you receive the one who sent me. Now at this point, I think the little child has probably been changed from actually a physical little child to a fellow Christian, to another one in the kingdom, perhaps one who's less knowledgeable than you are. And you help him, work with him, and you do it for his betterment, and you're doing it as if you were doing it to Christ. Think about Matthew 25, for example. Then he moves on, and in the same context of all this, the apostles, I think it's John, if I remember right, speaks up and says, Master, we saw one who does not follow with us casting out demons in your name. Now, I don't know the answer to this question. If it's someone that's not one of his disciples, casting out demons in Jesus' name, where to get the power to do it? Maybe somebody else could help me out there. I don't know where they got that miraculous power. When I was reading, it said, think about the 70 in Luke 10 that was sent out. Well, we're in Luke 9 now, so if Luke is anything like chronological, the 70 haven't been sent out yet, so they wouldn't have that power yet. So I'm not sure where the power to cast out demons in Jesus' name came from. I don't know the answer. So maybe somebody else does. But we saw someone casting out demons in your name. There's no indication that it did not work. I mean, it's like they did perform the miracle. And they said, we told them to stop. We told them they can't do this. And Jesus' answer was maybe a little surprising to them. He said, don't tell them to stop. Don't tell them to stop. He gives two reasons for it. He said, no one who works a miracle in my name is going to turn and speak against me after that. So if he's knows me, knows who I am, and can cast out demons in my name, then it's not likely he's going to turn and be opposed to me 5 minutes later, as you might get the idea. So that's one. And then it says, that we get a lot of sayings off of this these days, he who is not against us is on our side. So someone's casting out demons in my name, he's not against us, so therefore He's on our side. And then think about it, Matthew chapter 12, verse 30, where he says, he who's not with me is against me. And the vice versa of that will be true. Think about this a minute. How about one that's not either for Jesus or against Jesus? Or if he's that then, it's just indifferent. Based on Matthew 12, 30, where is he? If you're not with me, you're what? Against me. There's no middle road there. So one who is indifferent toward Christ, and I should say toward Christ instead of against Christ, would be those just as those who were against him or didn't obey him. So again, this we talked about before, there's no middle ground. There's either you're for it or you're against it. So then it moved. We're in chapter 18 now, by the way, Matthew. He talks about causing a fellow Christian to sin. And again, you think about referring to these little ones as being a fellow Christian. And he says, if you become a stumbling block, or if you cause a weaker saint, or the little ones, to sin, it'd be better off for you that you were dead. And he illustrates that by saying, tie a millstone around your neck and throw him into the sea. Just hear things years ago, somebody disappeared and said, well, somebody tied a concrete block around his neck, threw him in the lake out there or something. Same type concept. Tie a big millstone around somebody's neck and throw them in the sea where they're going. You'll be dead. They're going straight to the bottom. And that's the idea here. Don't cause another Christian to sin by being a stumbling block to them. That's his whole point. And then he says, woe to you when you cause these offenses. If you cause someone to stumble, he said you're better off to cut your hand off or to pluck out your eye. Now stop a minute. What does that remind you of? Sermon on the Mount. Where he's talking about if I sin, yeah, I'm better to cut my hand off or put my eye out, right? But now he's saying not if I'm sinning, but if I'm causing someone else to sin by my actions, I'm better off to cut my hand off or put my eye out. Now, I don't think he's talking about, in either case, physical mutilation of the body. That wouldn't help any. Body's going to be burned up anyhow. But it's what you're after. What's the whole point? It's a heart issue. What's my attitude? Am I causing someone to stumble? Am I causing an offense to someone? Am I causing a weak person to sin by my actions, by my example, by my words, or whatever? I think I got those on the slide here in a minute. He says you're better off. So cut your hand off or pluck your eye out, because that's better than being cast into everlasting fire. Again, not physically, I don't think, but get your attitude, get your heart right, because straighten this out where you're not causing someone else to stumble. It's better than being cast into everlasting fire. In Mark 9:48, it says, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Now, we'll come back and have one more line at the bottom of the slide in a minute, but let's look at this a minute. This is a map of, or a sketch of, Jerusalem. And coming down the right-hand side, down the eastern side of the city, is the Kidron Valley. Go down across this, back up the other side to the Mount of Olives, Garden of Gethsemane, go across the top of the mountain to the village of Bethany, whatever. But coming across the southern side is the Valley of Hinnom, H-I-N-N-O-M. And that valley is what's referred to with this, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. That was the garbage dump. And reading quite a bit about this, that's where, back in the olden times, they cast all the refuse, dead bodies of animals, and even someone went in one of the commentaries and said that even a stranger who came in and had no relatives or something died, they would throw that body in this fire. Don't know about that. That comment was made. But it's where everything got thrown that was trash, carcasses or whatever. And the fire burned there all the time. So that's why Jesus uses this as an example. Sorry, wrong button. Verse 48, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. Jesus apparently draws on the literal conditions of the Valley of Hinnom, where filth and debris are continually infested with worms and maggots. Worms never cease to exist, and the fire is never extinguished, an apt description of eternal or unceasing punishment in the pain and torment of the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. So, familiar to them, they know what it means. They talk about this place where the fire dieth not. Now, this is that matter today, by the way, just for what it's worth. So, coming back now to that other comment that I mentioned earlier to this, Jesus alludes to this, but does not actually directly say this here, eternal punishment. We talk about the everlasting fire, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Everlasting, eternal punishment. And he talks about what he came for and the value of a Christian to him. The Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. We've been through that several times, all the way back to Matthew chapter 1. Verse 21, when he talked to Joseph, the angel talked to Joseph. Jesus came and gave his life. So if he gave this much, how dare I call someone else to sin? If he gave that much for that person, and I'm being a stumbling block to them, how dare I do that? By my influence, by my example, by what I say. Think what Jesus gave for that person that I am causing to stumble. God cares about all of his sheep. Verse 13, I think it is, talks about the rejoicing over the one that they go and find that had gone astray, as opposed to the 99 who had not gone astray. So people are important. I got to be careful how I treat them. Then he kind of turns it around instead of me being an offense to someone else. What about someone who sins against me? Jesus said, if someone sins against you, you go to him. Just you. You go to him. And your purpose in going is to gain your brother. You go work it out. This gives a lot of people problems because they ignore this. What we do instead? Well, we're going to tell everybody else about it. Or I'm going to go see him, all right, but I'm going to tell him what I think about what he did. No. What's the purpose of going to sin? To gain my brother. If that doesn't work out, if you can't work it out between the two of you, then there's the next step given, where it says take one or two with you. That the mouth of two or three witnesses, things will be established. What I say to him, the way I treat him, my attitude toward him, and his reply, his response, how he deals with me, will be established by these witnesses that go with us. And then the third step, that doesn't work to get the problem resolved, so I bring it for the church. Again, with the purpose of getting my brother who has sinned against me. And that's the key thing, too, I think. A brother has sinned against me. It's not, he's upset me, made me mad, made part of it. But he's just talking about a brother who has sinned against me. And then following behind this is the idea of forgiveness. Am I to forgive my brother seven times? So, what does it mean to forgive him? What does forgiveness really mean? If I'm going to forgive, I'm going to treat my brother as if it never occurred. I don't harbor malice. I don't treat him unkindly. It's buried and gone because I forgave it. It's done. We worked it out. Forgiveness. And not just seven times seven. It's not the point. Now, it's his duty to ask for forgiveness. If he does, it's my duty to forgive him. Not I'll forgive you if, and all the conditions. My duty to forgive it. Now, what if he doesn't ask for forgiveness? Then what? Then what's my duty? Well, I still don't harbor malice and revenge and treat him ugly, talk about him. I still show my kindness and do good to him. I want to gain him back. I want to get him to ask for that forgiveness. What verse 35 says, you think back again to Matthew chapter 6, just after Jesus' prayer for his disciples, he talks about how's God going to forgive us the way we forgive others. Here he says, my heavenly Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart, I forgive him down deep. It's not an outward action. It's not, well, I'm going to act like it. I really don't. No. I forgive him from the heart. Completely. Just like I want God to forgive me. Chris, that comes up a lot, and I'll tell you my 2 cents worth on it, and everybody else who speak up is welcome to. I think I have to have a heart of forgiveness, always. And I treat him with kindness, no malice, no anger. I treat him kindly, whether he's asked for it or not. I think for forgiveness to take place, I ask for it. He has to ask for it. Otherwise, we're on a continual cleansing type process there. So it gets busy. Yeah. Yeah. From me and the way I treat him, I don't see any difference. Do I have a heart, an attitude of forgiveness toward it? Again, forgiveness to actually take place, I think he asked for it. That don't mean I'm going to treat him ugly till he does. Okay. There's a piece here about commitment. Those who follow Jesus, let me go bury my dead father, things like this. So I'll follow you wherever you go. And the question I ask here is, what commitment did you make or did I make when I became a Christian? I'll follow you, Jesus, as long as, and here's my conditions. So have I been true to that commitment that I made? Not that there are any conditions. Take that back. Don't get the wrong idea. What did it cost me? What did it cost me to follow Jesus? I'll go back and think about the verse we talked about earlier. Am I really denying myself, put my interests aside so I can follow him? Has it been worth it? Will it be worth it in the long run? And then the last thing it's talked about in this section gets us down to where we're ready to begin, the close of the ministry period. That's in John 7. Time period here is about October. 6 months before Jesus will die the next spring, April. And it's time to go to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. And so his brothers, his physical brothers, talked to him about going. You need to go down there and, if you were a minister to those people down there, let them see you and who you are. And think about a couple of his brothers, who they are. Best we can tell, James, who wrote the book of James, and it's mentioned in Acts 15, prominent in the church, early church in Jerusalem, where the controversy came up, and Paul and Silas went down to Jerusalem. James is one of Christ's physical brothers. Jude, who wrote the book of Jude, is another one. So his physical brothers here talked to him about going to Jerusalem. Then he tells them, no, I'm not going now. You go on. And then it says later on, he came, but he came secretly. People thought not know who he was. Exactly what that entails, I'm not sure. But he went to Jerusalem for the feast, as was required of the law. They did not go openly and go with his brothers, but they went. And that sets us up then, that's all the four periods of retirement. And so now we're ready for the close of ministry, the last 6 months. That's where this quarter ends. Go back to this verse here for just 1 minute. We got about 2 minutes left. He who humbles himself, the little child, we mentioned that earlier. What does it mean to humble yourself or myself? We all know James 4, verse 10, song written on this verse. Humble yourself to the side of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Humility. So the question that I ask is, do you want to be the greatest or are you going to be the most humble? Their discussion was about being the greatest in the kingdom. So do you want to be the greatest or are you going to be the most humble? Well, here's my answer to that. The greatest will be the most humble. Because to be great in the kingdom, you're going to have to be humble. I don't see a difference between the two. Jesus says, whoever humbles himself will be the greatest in the kingdom. I must show humility. So I can't be great without having humility. If I have humility, I'm going to be great in the kingdom. See that the two interchange? Seems to me they do. That was Jesus' answer to his apostles when they were debating this. Humility, having or showing a modest or low esteem of one's own importance, goes right back to deny himself. Take my interest out of it. That's what humility is. Take my interest out so I can follow the Master. Okay, that's the end of it, I think. Yep. The books, again, I remind you, when we break up here, we're about to. They're on this back corner over here if you want to get one for next quarter. if you'll be in here next quarter. And all 22 lessons are in the one book, so you won't be any pieces to add together like we did this time. So you're welcome to get those and be ready for the next Sunday. Okay, thank you very much.